This is audiobook in MP3, of Extract from, Secret History, and Why Barack Obama Must End It, by Tony Brunt. Foreword. History is hard enough to do even when all the facts are on the table. But when crucial events have been hidden or, even worse, convincingly denied and ridiculed, keeping your balance becomes extremely difficult. Historical writing in the 20th century has been irreparably damaged and at best debased by the UFO cover-up. The century's front-page lead, The Discovery That We Were Not Alone, was censored. Other large font stories replaced it: wars, technological revolutions, a population explosion. These events deserved banner headlines, but they paled before the discovery that mankind had company. In consigning the hard UFO evidence to a place of safe sequestration, officialdom not only diminished 50 years of historiography, it changed the course of history itself. It precluded history. It prevented alternatives, perhaps better scenarios, from arising. The architects of the plot may argue that they saved us from social instability and the disintegration of important institutions. But any defense of their hidden paternalism looks decidedly shaky as ecological disaster and a violent and myopic religious fundamentalism threaten the planet. It would be a brave man who could say with any confidence that neither of these intractable problems, one technical and the other doctrinal, could have been lessened by the expansionary impact of disclosure and purposeful contact. From this perspective, the cover-up begins to look less like kindness and more like tragedy, a public manipulation whose opportunity cost was, in the end, not worth it. It was with the election of Barack Obama in 2008 that these thoughts began to sharpen in my mind. The ascension of an impressive young president seemed like the perfect opportunity to advocate a new start, to convince the powerful to throw off the hidden baggage of the past that had become a deadweight on sensible decision-making, to try and make sense of it all, to apply an historical perspective and use this to chart a way forward. I spent some months in 2009 preparing the first three essays in the Secret History series that were uploaded progressively to the Ifocus NZ website. There was no overarching architecture to the articles. They reflected rather an impulsive decision to leap into the water and go with the current. As things turned out, there was a rough structure to the final product. They were not essays in the strict sense, more a combination of narrative and struggling insights that dropped out of the bottom. The best historians, as with the best scientists, have kept away from the UFO subject for their own professional survival. So only the observations of a second-rate mind are available. I trumpeted the Secret History series as an attempt to go behind the approved, standardized version of the 20th century, to assess the post-war impact of the UFO phenomenon. This was pretentious hype, but yet still pointed in the intended direction of travel. Part 1. The challenge for a new president. Proffered advice to the Obama White House that was likely to run counter to what the president's cautious insiders would tender. It also looked back at early events in the 1940s to see how we had got ourselves into such a mess. Part 2. The Price of Deceit. Segued off to deal in some depth with the advent of equals the Grays in the 1940s and the high price, mentally, suffered by some of those who designed the cover-up and were exposed to a disturbing new cosmology. These two installments are included as appendices to this book. Part 3. George Adamski. The Toughest Job in the World. Was an attempt to show that there was a more hopeful side to this business. There was a definite benevolent potential to the alien interaction. It contradicted America's gloomy preoccupation with the Grays, and the dismal policy choices that were made. The Adamski book is available as a free download on the Scribd website. Part 4. Secret History, and Why Barack Obama Must End It, which now appears here for the first time, tries to come to grips with the impact of the whole thing in a larger sense. It looks at the drivers of the official head-in-the-sand approach and some of the actors who brought us to the truly astonishing, and paralytic, situation that we now find ourselves in. There is, of course, a book in all this, a thick one, rather than a series of essays. But I am not smart enough or patient enough to write it. Nor is the UFO field a particularly profitable area, mentally, in which to dwell for long. It suffers from the problem of lying outside the consensus reality on which our current society operates. As a consequence, it is a disorienting and uncomfortable place to be. It is a foggy shore best used for a quick dip near the water's edge rather than prolonged immersion. In addition, our lives are generally happier when played out on the smaller stages of family and community. National and global affairs tend not to be prime sources of human contentment. To add another layer of extraterrestrial affairs on top of all this is not a surefire formula for increasing the sum of human happiness. Nevertheless, the visitors are here and we must deal with them openly and extract from the relationship all that we can to improve and perhaps rescue our planetary situation. To allow this novel dialogue and diplomacy, which will clearly be multilateral in nature because there are many of them visiting, to be carried out in secret will most assuredly not lead to the best outcome. These essays are a small part of the global campaign to try and force disclosure of the truth. They are acts of journalism rather than acts of scholarship, as the reader will quickly realize. They contain just about all that I want to say on this vexed subject. There is some originality in them. I have tried not to repeat the work and insights of others. I have departed from the rest of the literature by assuming, on good evidence, that the cover-up exists rather than wasting valuable time trying to prove it. Severing the link with flying saucer forensics frees one to float upwards and achieve a higher perspective. If you find these articles readable and instructive, I will be happy. If they act as a spur to some sort of action, personal or political, even better. Tony Brunt, June, 2011. The start of the trail these days. Raymond Fowler, of Kennebunk, Maine, is in his late 70s, but you wouldn't know it from his busy schedule. Sure, he recently sold the planetarium and observatory that he ran in his spare time for 39 years, but other activities have taken up the slack. He promotes sales of his 11 books through his own website and he teaches adult education classes in astronomy and other subjects. Fowler jogs, bikes, fly fishes, canoes, skis and rehearses for his roster as a bass soloist at the local church. Oh, and there's also the small matter of a vegetable garden that he tends with his wife, Margaret. We grow and freeze enough vegetables to last almost a year, he says with deserved pride. Despite the passage of time, Ray Fowler still displays the energy and enterprise that marked him out years ago as one of the most skilled and respected UFO researchers in the United States. Never one to take a story at face value, Fowler displayed a tenacity and thoroughness that made his investigation reports models of their kind. They always found an attentive and respectful following among the staff at NICAP headquarters in Washington, D.C. NICAP, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, was a conservative organization that collected UFO reports between the years 1957 to 1969 and lobbied hard for official recognition of the UFO phenomenon. Ray Fowler was one of its star East Coast investigators. These days his appetite for travel and sleuthing in search of a good paranormal yarn has faded, but he still has clear memories of the intriguing case that propelled him into the spotlight 35 years ago. This widely quoted account did not require much gumshoe work at all. In fact, it was almost delivered to his door. In 1973, Fowler was working for Sylvania Electric Systems, at Needham, Massachusetts, as a senior planner on the Minuteman missile project, when he heard on the grapevine about a local who claimed to have attended a flying saucer crash in Arizona some years before. Fowler picked up the scent and followed it in a trail that circled back to his large Sylvania campus, to an engineer working in a nearby building on software support for the Apollo space project. Arthur G. Stansel headed up the software project and was willing to talk about his otherworldly experience so long as his identity was protected. Fowler coined the cover name, Fritz Werner, to shield his informant from ridicule and retribution. The two men had a lot in common and became fast friends, so much so that Stansel revealed in extraordinary depth the details of his experience and the broad outlines of the classified work that he had been involved in for the Air Force. Fowler's report on his Stansel interviews and careful background checks would stretch to 65 pages and take its place as a classic of UFO crash, retrieval report age. As a measure of the tale's subsequent fame, a Google search of Fritz Werner UFO yields 430,000 results. Before we deal in any depth with the Kingman, Arizona, UFO crash of 1953, we should flesh out the character of Arthur Stansel to show that he was not your typical phantom lurking in the margin of flying saucer folklore. His death in New Hampshire in 2006 frees researchers to draw on the full depth of the eulogies and life account that his wife, Doris, and his three children traversed at the time of his passing at age 82. When he graduated from high school in Kettering, Ohio, Stansel was a member of a national champion high school band as well as an athlete on the baseball, basketball and track teams. Trained as a combat infantryman during World War II, he took part in the D-Day landings at Normandy in June 1944 at the age of 19. Here he was wounded for the first of three times. He took another hit as his unit fought their way across France. Then at the Battle of the Bulge he was wounded for a third time and evacuated back to the States with a Bronze Star and three Purple Hearts on his dress uniform. Stansel was a man who clearly had no qualms about putting himself in harm's way, a courage which showed in his later revelations to Fowler, which, though disguised by a pseudonym, were easily backtracked by determined Air Force investigators. After the war, Stansel attended Miami University of Ohio, where he graduated in 1948 with a degree in math and physics. He then obtained a master's degree in diesel engineering at North Carolina State. From 1949 to 1958 as a civilian at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, in Ohio, he worked on a wide range of sensitive projects, firstly as an engineer, and then in supervisory roles. At the time of the Kingman crash, Stansel was working in the Air Material Command Installations Division, within the Office of Special Studies, whose chief was Dr. Eric Wang. Stansel was on special assignment to the Eck at the Atomic Proving Ground in Nevada, measuring blast effects on various types of buildings when he was co-opted for an unusual assignment. On May 20, 1953, I worked most of the day at Frenchman Flat. In the evening, I received a phone call from the test director, Dr. Ed Dull, informing me that I was to go on a special job the next day, Stansel told Fowler. On the following day, around 4:30 p.m., I reported for special duty and was driven to Indian Springs Air Force Base near the Proving Ground, where I joined about 15 other specialists. We were told to leave all valuables in the custody of the military police. I gave them my wallet, watch, pen and other things I don't remember. We were then put on a military airplane and flown to Phoenix. We were not allowed to fraternize. There, we were put on a bus with other personnel who were already there. The bus windows were all blacked out, so that we couldn't see where we were going. We rode for an estimated 4 hours. I think we were in the area of Kingman, Arizona, which is northwest of Phoenix and not too far from the Atomic Proving Ground in Nevada. During the bus trip, we were told by an Air Force full colonel that a super-secret Air Force vehicle had crashed and that since we were all specialists in certain fields, we were to investigate the crash in terms of our own specialty and nothing more. Finally, the bus stopped and we disembarked one at a time as our names were called, and escorted by military police to the area that we were to inspect. Two spotlights were centered on the crashed object, which was ringed with guards. The lights were so bright that it was impossible to see the surrounding area. The object was oval and looked like two deep saucers, one inverted upon the other. It was about 30 feet in diameter with convex surfaces, top and bottom. These surfaces were about 20 feet in diameter. Part of the object had sunk into the ground. It was constructed of a dull silver metal like brushed aluminum. The metal was darker where the saucer equals lips formed a rim, around which were what looked like slots. A curved open hatch door was located on the leading end and was vertically lowered. There was a light coming from inside, but it could have been installed by the Air Force. My particular job was to determine from the angle and the depth of impact into the sand, how fast the vehicle's forward and vertical velocities were at the time of impact. The impact had forced the vehicle approximately 20 inches into the sand. There were no landing gear. There also were no marks or dents, that I can remember, on the surface, not even scratches. Questions asked, having nothing to do with our own special areas, were not answered. An armed military policeman guarded a tent pitched nearby. I managed to glance inside at one point and saw the dead body of a 4-foot human-like creature in a silver metallic-looking suit. The skin on its face was dark brown. This may have been caused by exposure to our atmosphere. It had a metallic skull-cap device on its head. As soon as each person finished his task, he was interviewed over a tape recorder and escorted back to the bus. On the way, I managed to talk briefly with someone else who told me that he had glanced inside the object and saw two swivel-like seats as well as instruments and displays. An airman, noticing us talking together, separated us and warned us not to talk with each other. Stansel was returned to his job in Nevada and tendered a written report as instructed. He told Ray Fowler that he sympathized with the secret handling of the UFO problem. Back in 1953, the Air Force did not know where UFOs originated, apart from the belief that they were interplane ferry vehicles. Fowler checked out Stansel's professional resume by calling former employers. All held him in high esteem. Everyone described him as a highly competent, technical, and moral individual, reported Fowler. Neither of the two former Blue Book officials that I talked with would confirm the incident. One asked, "Equals, where is the object now?" The other got very nervous when I mentioned Dr. Eric Wang's Office of Special Studies, where Stansel was working at the time. He asked me to leave him alone, as he wanted to live out his life in privacy. The EC, Atomic Energy Commission, in Washington and in Nevada both confirmed the dates and names of the atomic tests that Stansel had mentioned to Fowler. They also confirmed the name of the test director, Dr. Ed Dole, and the chief of the Office of Special Studies as the technical and scientific monitor for the atomic test project. Further investigation revealed that Dr. Wang had died. I did manage to track Dr. Dole to Stanford Research Institute, Fowler wrote, but their personnel department did not know his whereabouts. They felt he had died. On June 7, 1973, Arthur Stansel signed an affidavit, at Fowler's request, that attested to his role at the Kingman crash site. Though the UFO cover-up has been a sad American invention, the Fowler-Stansel report casts the stars and stripes in a more positive light. Here we have two impressive and upright citizens acting with conscience and clarity in the freedom of their democracy to reveal a truth that they believed shouldn't be hidden. After his years in the Air Force, Stansel went on to put the seal on his rookie to rockstar CV. He worked on activation mechanisms for the Curtis Wright Corporation in Caldwell, New Jersey, and then on aircraft landing systems, a task that took him to Greenland and the South Pole. He moved to New England in the 1960s as an employee of Raytheon Corporation, where he spent 12 years as principal engineer of the company's Apollo space program before moving to Sylvania. It appears that Stansel was not targeted for reprisal following his gutsy confession to Fowler. Probably he knew that his record of service to his country in both war and peace gave him a moral ascendancy that no denizens of MJ-12 could diminish. He retired in 1987 and moved to leafy New Ipswich, in rural New Hampshire, where he gave his time generously to the local community hospital, volunteering over 2,000 hours, and to the New Ipswich Congregational Church, where he served as assistant treasurer. He had an interest in music and sports, I see, according to an obituary. He was an avid reader, enjoyed hiking and bird watching with his wife, and spending time with his 7 grandchildren. Arthur Stansel's life and integrity stand as a testament to all that is good about America. The torch passes to Stinman. Fowler did not publicize the Fuchs-Werner story until 1976. It raised eyebrows among UFO buffs who had rarely seen such detailed revelations from an insider. Then the case faded from the headlines. 7 years went by. In the early 1980s, another researcher decided to gather up a loose end from the Fuchs-Werner story. He began digging for information about Eric Wang. William Stinman, a quality assurance worker in the California aerospace industry, began sustained and passionate research into uncovering the truth about UFOs after reading Frank Scully's book, Behind the Flying Saucers. His record of achievement in the few years that he devoted to the subject is impressive, especially his ability to winkle out remarkable revelations from insiders who were prepared to talk about crash disks and the reverse engineering program. Stinman blazed across the firmament like a, well, UFO, for 5 or 6 years before he quietly exited the flying saucer field. His risky activities earned him the close attention of intelligence agencies. His home in Los Angeles was buzzed by unmarked helicopters, an harassment tactic occasionally reported by other U.S. researchers. His mail was tampered with and his phone apparently tapped. One day he even found a tracking device fitted to the bottom of his van. Today Stinman lives in retirement, keeping his head well below the parapet. His initial attempts to find references to Wang in scientific and engineering journals drew a blank. He began to think that the man's existence had been deliberately covered up. Eventually a brief reference was found to a Wang obituary having appeared in the April 1961 issue of Mechanical Engineering. Steinman traveled all over Los Angeles trying to find the magazine, but in each of the library collections he searched, that particular issue had been removed. Eventually he found one at Long Beach Public Library. That was the only oversight. He wrote later. Stinman found that Eric Henry Wang had been born in Vienna, Austria, in 1906. He received his engineering degree at the Technical University of Vienna in 1935. His movements over the next few years are unknown, but by 1943 he was on the staff of the University of Cincinnati, in Ohio, where he taught engineering and mathematics until 1952. Wang started working on government projects at the Air Force's Wright Air Development Center in 1949 and left the university to take up full-time civilian employment there in 1952. In 1956 the department he headed was moved to Albuquerque, New Mexico, to Kirtland Air Force Base Sandia Laboratories Complex. Wang remained there until his death in December 1960, at the age of 54. The dog Stinman built a confidence with another insider who supplied more details about Wang. The low-profile Austrian had apparently been involved with the early stages of the flying disc designs of fellow Vienna Tech graduate Victor Schauberger. After his emigration to America, Wang became involved in the Air Force attempts to figure out the propulsion mechanisms of the crashed discs, work which became an all-consuming passion. In 1956 the Department of Special Studies was relocated 2,000 miles to Albuquerque so that Wang could work hands-on with the craft recovered from Roswell, Aztec and elsewhere. Stinman now had a bit between his teeth. On March 23, 1984, he wrote to Mrs. Maria Wang, Eric's widow, asking if she was able to provide more details about his work. There was no reply. If attempts had been made to cover up her late husband's existence, Maria Wang had not cooperated. Several years after his death she had endowed the Eric H. Wang Civil Engineering Research Facility, at the University of New Mexico, Albuquerque. She increased her own profile, becoming a leading light in the Albuquerque Woman's Club, which she served for some years as president. When Maria Wang failed to reply to his letter, Stinman picked up the phone one day in May and called her. The conversation went as follows, W.S., my name is William Steinman. I wrote the letter to you on the 23rd of March in regards to Dr. Eric Henry Wang and his work involving analyses on recovered flying saucers, and the attempted duplication of them. M.W., yes, I do remember the letter but I no longer have it. W.S., what happened to the letter? M.W., I turned it over to the authorities. W.S., which authorities? M.W., military intelligence at Kirtland Air Force Base. W.S., can you tell me something about Dr. Wang's involvement in the Flying Saucer Project? M.W., how did you know that Dr. Wang was involved in that kind of work? Why do you want to know about that? Who are you? How do I know that I can trust you? Stinman went into a long explanation of his interest and his belief in the need for openness. He believed the entire scientific community should be involved in studying the crashed sources. M.W., how can I help you? Dr. Wang's papers were all confiscated by military intelligence when he died. His notes were written in his own unique version of German scientific shorthand. Those papers were placed behind lock and key within a special sealed-off section of a highly secret section of the library at Kirtland Air Force Base. W.S., can you please describe exactly what kind of work Dr. Wang was doing on the sources? M.W., I can't tell you over the phone. I don't know you at all, and besides, the entire subject is classified above top secret. W.S., were the sources made on Earth? And if so, were they originally of German technology? M.W., no. To both questions, the person you should write to in government is Dr. Henry Kissinger. He is deeply involved in the flying saucer program. In fact, he was completely in charge of it at the time that Dr. Wang was still alive and involved with it. W.S., can you please write to me in detail describing Dr. Wang's work with the flying saucer program? M.W., give me your address and phone number and I will see what I can do. So there we have it, the end of the trail, a sneak peek through the veil to the Forbidden Zone where one of the most famous power players of the last 50 years, Henry Kissinger, was shown to act in a remarkable role unknown to historians. That is what we have been reduced to in divining the true outlines of the secret history of the 20th century, relying on such things as a chance remark by a 78-year-old Albuquerque widow whose honesty seems above question. On such slender threads hangs so much that we should have known. A look at Henry Kissinger. The exposure of Kissinger as a central figure in the cover-up and technical exploitation of recovered discs is yet again a grim reminder of the vast dimension of the problem we are dealing with, the scale and effectiveness of both the conspiracy and the administrative machinery that was put in place to sustain it. Its successful operation required a control structure that could monitor and manipulate multiple facets of American society and, by proxy, world society. Its imperatives would impact on politics, science, communications, the news media, diplomatic endeavor, military activity, espionage policy, budgetary practices, academia, and research and development, both public and private. In other words, the maintenance of equals the secret and the technical program that was its raison d'etre required a vigilance and broad surveillance that is the closest America has ever come to totalitarianism in peacetime. And yet it was a soft totalitarianism, a web of eyes and ears and levers that was, for the most part, camouflaged from its victims by a propaganda coup that persisted not just for decades but for generations. The cover-up and its machinery did not get in the way of happiness and the conduct of fulfilled lives. Therefore, it could never become a visceral political issue. It was the deception that millions of Americans knowingly allowed their government to indulge in. It was marginal to their interests. It could be tolerated almost with a nudge and a wink. It looked like a victimless crime. There were many close shaves for the conspirators, many times when UFO activists nearly scored a equals gotcha moment. Henry Kissinger once famously said that academic disputes were so bitter because the stakes were so low. Americans tolerated their government's indignant protestations of innocence because the stakes were so low. And yet it can be argued that the cover-up and the activity it shielded represents, in its duration, one of the most ruinous public policies in American history. Springing Henry Kissinger as a central figure is not so surprising when we look at his background. Kissinger was a refugee from Nazi Germany in 1937 who returned to Europe in 1945 as a sergeant in the United States Army Counterintelligence Corps, CIC. He returned to America in 1947 at the age of 24 and gained entry to Harvard University. Here he dabbled in chemistry and math but then went on to perform distinguished scholarship in philosophy, history and government. Dr. Kissinger's CV headlines a high road that led onto the elitist and influential Council of Foreign Relations, public service on Rockefeller family projects, and then a professorship in Harvard's government department.